I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome back to Radio Times. As consumers, we expect to have the things we order arrive on our doorsteps ASAP. The same goes for stores and factories. But have you thought about what it takes to make that happen? Chances are it involves a long-haul truck driver who lives out of their cab for weeks, hauling goods for low pay, often under difficult conditions. This hour of Radio Times, we're talking about the American trucking industry, the lure of the road, and the toll the job can take on workers. Producer Elizabeth Fiedler sat down with Steve Viselli, author of the new book, The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. They talked about why some truckers spend 30-plus hours on the job without getting paid, the grueling working conditions, and the loneliness of being away from home for weeks at a time. Viselli, who drove a truck for his research, began by reading from the introduction.
Several months into my work as a trucker, I recorded the following notes in my audio journal. May 18th, 8:30 p.m. I'm stuck at a railroad yard in New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from Manhattan. I got here around 6:30 after fighting rush hour traffic, all the way from Long Island through New York City. When I arrived, the clerk said my company needed to fax my name, driver's license number, and company codes for the load I'm picking up before he could process it. It took more than an hour and a half for the evening shift dispatcher to fax the information. Why can't they have that stuff ready? Now I'm really screwed. According to government regulations, I can only work one more hour today before I take a 10-hour break. The load is scheduled to be in Rhode Island, and I was planning to make it to Connecticut tonight, and I still don't have the load. I don't think I'll be able to find parking north of the city now, which means I've got to find some place to park near here tonight, and I'll have to fight traffic on the Cross Bronx Expressway tomorrow morning. That will cost me a lot of time, not to mention the stress. I hate that damn road. Once again, the only one who isn't getting paid is me. My dispatchers are getting paid, and the guy in the guard shack is getting paid.
And for a book about trucking, I think the emotion really comes out in that passage. How were you feeling at the time when you wrote that?
Well, first I felt tired. So I was days into what was a 12-day work rotation at that point, and maybe I was 9 or so days in, I think. And, you know, had just worked almost a 16-hour, by the end I will have worked a 16-hour day. I was probably 14 hours into it at that point. And so exhausted and frustrated. And part of that frustration comes from the fact that, as I said in that note, you're not getting paid. You only get paid for the miles that you drive for the most part. So when you show up at a shipping location, whether it be a customer's dock or a distribution center or a rail yard, all that time that you spend finding the trailer, dealing with paperwork, waiting for them to load the truck, you're not getting paid.
And that was one thing that I found quite surprising, that mere fact that as a trucker you're not being paid for every minute or every hour of your time and you have to wait essentially for free.
Estimates vary, but some people can spend 30-plus hours a week waiting unpaid.
Wow. And that experience, the one that you just read from your book, came on one of your many bad days on the job while you were working as a long-haul trucker researching this book. You wrote that night you slept in a railroad yard with no access to food or a bathroom. You were tired. You were frustrated. Was that a typical experience during your time on the job?
It wasn't typical, but it does happen, you know, and it's one of the experiences that sticks with you. They're doing all of the required work for moving the freight that you and I get in all kinds of forms. But everyone who has a need to slow that work down for them, whether it be a warehouse worker who has another load that takes priority or a dock that doesn't have free space, they don't. The shippers and the carriers don't worry about the truck driver's time because it's unpaid. And so they're kind of the slack absorbers of freight movement, really.
And it wasn't always this way. Trucking used to be one of the best working class jobs in America. And I know that it's now the number one occupation in many states, something like 35, 37 states. How has the job changed over the years, over the decades?
Oh, it's really changed radically. So if we were to go back prior to deregulation of the industry, which happened beginning in the late 1970s, the vast majority of truck drivers were union members. They were members of the Teamsters Union, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Most of them would have been home every night or every other night for the most part. they were making salaries that in today's dollars would be worth more than $100,000 a year. And so what's happened to the job over time is that the process of moving the freight is kind of what we economists and sociologists would call sped up. Workers are asked to do more work in less time, and sometimes that's just because they're staying out overnight on the road, which most truckers do now, living out of their trucks for 24 hours a day, sometimes for 12 or 19 days at a time in my case, and they're working for up to 40% lower wages. Now, before, when the Teamsters were in control of trucking's labor markets, workers had a lot of say over what was happening on those docks. They were able to have regular input as to what their interests were about how freight was moved and how their labor was employed.
And what does the average trucker make now after deregulation?
So it varies by segment, but and it depends on what labor or what data source you use, but somewhere in the neighborhood of $40,000 a year.
And does that seem like enough to you?
Well, when you consider that they work oftentimes the equivalent of two full-time jobs and the fact that they have to be out on the road for weeks at a time, no, not at all. And I think truckers would agree with me on that one.
And what's the current limit on the number of hours truckers can drive?
60 hours over 7 days or 70 hours over 8 days. I worked far in excess of that, as most drivers do.
And how do they manage to do that if there's actually a limitation?
So when you record your hours in the logbook, and most drivers don't necessarily feel like they're doing anything illegal when they do it, but you simply record the time that you spend waiting at customer locations as off-duty time when, in fact, according to the rules, every minute you spend on a customer location should be recorded as work time.
So falsifying the records, though, you're saying it doesn't seem as though that's what they're doing at the time, maybe.
Well, oftentimes drivers convince themselves that this is the way that they ought to interpret the rules, right? That, well, I'm in the back and I'm trying to take a nap. How could that possibly be working, right? But in fact, the way that the rules are written, and you're not going to be getting good sleep in that sleeper berth while they're loading your truck. All that time really should be logged as work time. But of course, that's going to take away from the hours you can make money.
Talk to me about unions and about why deregulation eventually occurred.
Yeah, so deregulation limited competition in the industry by preventing companies coming in and undercutting the rates of existing firms. And labor actually helped to maintain the regulation because it kept firms from expanding into new areas or upstarts from coming into the industry. And trucking has a problem that it's derived demand, meaning that you have to have stuff there to move. You can't store up trucking services into the future, put them in a warehouse or something like that. And so whenever there's profit to be made, whenever rates are good, meaning there's a shortage of trucks, it's very easy to add trucks and bring down that rate of profitability. But when demand is slack and you have overhead like trucks on the road, everybody keeps their trucks moving. And so you can pretty quickly go negative. And regulation was meant to prevent that from causing destructive competition, meaning that you'd have lots of volatility in the industry and companies wouldn't be able to invest enough to maintain high-quality service and equipment. And so unions were the complement to that in many ways because they stabilized the labor supply.
So it sounds like there were really much larger forces at work politically and across the country that that led eventually to the deregulation.
Yeah, so there was a big push from shippers who, you know, you can think about sort of the Sears and Roebucks of the day who were the most advanced. They were the Amazon of the 1960s and 70s who were very interested in lowering labor costs, increasing the flexibility and speed of trucking services. And without the push to deregulation and the sort of changes that happened, it'd be very hard to imagine globalization as we've experienced it happening. You wouldn't have the returns on national markets that your big box stores get today.
Are there truckers who are unionized now?
There still are some unionized truck drivers. And, you know, the most notable group in this regard is UPS drivers, who constitute a large chunk of the Teamsters membership.
Did you take a look at how the work that they do, the unionized truckers, how that might differ from the majority of the other truckers who are not unionized?
I did. And what ends up happening is that in certain segments of the industry, unions are more or less prevalent because they are more or less possible for workers to organize. And so in over-the-road trucking, the segment that I spend most of the time focusing on in the book, there are virtually no unionized drivers left.
And what is the term over-the-road truckers?
And I should clarify, it's over-the-road truckload. So over-the-road means that you're typically traveling more than 150 miles from your home location, or sometimes it's called long haul. And truckload basically means that you're delivering an entire trailer worth of goods from one point to another rather than a mix of shipments or parcels as a UPS driver would.
And what sort of goods are we talking about? What's in the back of that trailer that you're driving?
Well, this was one of the fun parts about working as a truck driver was realizing that it's everything. It's everything you can think of, from pillows going to Target to diapers to beer. Anything that you can put in a cardboard box or on a pallet can go in one of these trucks.
And did you stick primarily in one region of America, or did you really cover the entire country?
I delivered stuff from Florida to Maine, from Wisconsin to Texas, so the eastern half of the U.S.
Was it harder than you expected to be a trucker?
I had some experiences before in high school and college working some really crappy jobs. And so I was used to working really long, odd hours. And so I think that made the job a little bit easier on me, but it is a tough job physically, sitting in that position, living out of the truck, mentally, in terms of dealing with those long hours and fatigue and making sure that you're operating safely, and emotionally, where you really want to be home. You know, sometimes you just I tell a story in the book about the 4th of July and being at a truck stop and my wife calling and telling me about the family barbecue back home and watching kind of the fireworks on the horizon sort of thing, eating really bad Chinese food and thinking, this is not what I want to be doing with my life right now. This is, and I wasn't working. I was actually stuck for a full day with nothing to do because I couldn't deliver until after the holiday. And so I'm unpaid, I'm bored, but I'm also angry that my time's being wasted.
And far from home.
Yeah, very far from home.
We're listening to producer Elizabeth Fiedler's interview with Steve Viselli, author of The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. Viselli's also a sociologist, a Fox Family Pavilion scholar, a senior fellow at the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. You can join the conversation by tweeting us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can join us on Facebook. More after this very short break. This is Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoway. Let's get back to Elizabeth Fiedler's interview with Steve Viselli about long-haul truck drivers. You can join the conversation on Twitter and on Facebook.
The majority of these truckers are white men. What else can you tell me about the truckers, who they are, where they come from, if there are any common links between their education or backgrounds, geography?
Yeah, it's really an incredibly, once you limit it to sort of white men, there's incredible diversity within that group, meaning that, and also black men as well. These are historically the primary sources of labor for long-haul trucking is white and black men. Once you look within their kind of histories and where they're coming from, it's incredibly diverse. So I describe the truckers that I met as kind of being part of three groups. A third of them kind of fell into trucking. They did something related to trucking, warehousing, et cetera, and it seemed like a natural fit. Other ones were kind of pushed into trucking, I say, who are, usually blue-collar workers who had a better job either in a factory or a skilled trade and got pushed in there because they lost the job and trucking was a way to maintain their wages. And then another third is kind of pulled into the industry, I say, which are tend to be more service workers who have never earned a wage that high and are attracted by the higher wages that trucking at least promises.
And we've been talking a lot about men here. Certainly the mental image that I get when I think of a trucker is of a man. And I read that only about 5% of these drivers are women. Did you meet any female truckers in your travels? And can you tell me a little bit about their experiences?
Yeah, so this is one of the big issues for the industry, and it's a question that I get a lot. If we were to look at the kind of truck drivers that I'm really focusing on, sort of individual drivers doing long-haul driving, women would probably represent about 1% of that population. Now, overall, because of local driving and other kinds of driving, you'll find more women in other segments. And some women do, in fact, the majority of women who enter the long-haul driving and stay in long-haul driving are doing so because they have a significant other who's already in the industry or who they're going in with. And in general, I would say, I talk about one woman, Kathy, that I met in the book, and her experiences, I think, resonate with the other women that I've talked to from the industry, that there are really multiple extensive barriers to women participating in this labor market, which range all the way from the potential for sexual harassment during training, because the training process is one in which an experienced driver takes the inexperienced driver on the road and they live together in a truck, and then that experienced driver has the right to essentially the ability to say whether or not that person gets a job. We can imagine, right, that this can be problematic for lots of people. And then from that experience all the way through to the safety of truck stops themselves, sexual harassment over the CB, et cetera. And there are many barriers to women entering the labor force in greater numbers.
And a few very concrete ones. I read about a new organization called Women in Trucking that was pushing truck stops to carry more women's clothing, women's toiletries, pushing truck manufacturers even to design the seats in the truck so they're more ergonomically friendly to women. All sorts of things that, as an industry, if there have not been many women in it, maybe haven't been thought about or did not make economic sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And the industry is desperate to get women in as part of their labor force in greater numbers. And they're working on various attempts, some of which, I as I suggest in the book, are maybe counterproductive. So there's a major magazine, industry magazine called Overdrive, that has their most beautiful competition every year, where truckers can vote on the most beautiful female truck driver. Drivers are nominated. And, of course, they are clear and point out that it's not just external beauty that they're looking for, but also internal beauty.
Of course not.
So that was one of their attempts to make the occupation seem less masculine and make it seem possible for women to do the job.
And you mentioned that many of the women who work in this industry, in fact, work alongside their significant other. I read a CNBC piece about a woman from Delaware, a 28-year-old female truck driver, who did exactly that. She drives along with her husband. They take turns. That means that they can drive for more hours continuously. Was that the sort of situation that you encountered frequently? In some ways, it seems to me like a brilliant idea, just in the sense that you could continue to drive and have a relationship.
It does become a solution to have your significant other, especially once the kids are out of the house. That's usually when it happens. As truckers would say, the kids are out of the house, and so, you know, the wife and I can go on the road. And that is not super common, but it is certainly the most common way that women, again, will sort of get in and stay in the industry. And it does make the job more sustainable for men who are really feeling the strain of not being home.
And what about the trucks that these truckers are spending so much time in, these huge vehicles that are built to withstand hours and hours of cross-country travel? What do we know about those trucks?
These trucks are, you know, they're work machines. They're, you know, sometimes it's tempting to think about them as similar to your personal vehicle or something along those lines. But they're really a work machine, and they're designed, you know, fundamentally to do that. So they end up, you know, lasting for a long, long time, years and years and years, given the amount that they're driven. So they'll have more than 1 million miles on them before they come off the road and go into local driving, which turns out to be a pretty big problem because we end up with lots of dirty burning diesel trucks doing the local city driving that when we'd rather have them out of the cities. But they're set up so that the driver can literally live out of them, with the exception of needing a bathroom. You can eat out of them. Most of them will have a small refrigerator or even a 12-volt stove. And they really become your home away from home, which makes the ergonomics of it and all of that that much more important, because there are a lot of injuries that can come just from living and working in this vehicle on end.
For example?
So repetitive stress injuries are something that is a huge concern for the industry. Just sitting in that chair sometimes for 10 hours a day or longer, the kind of movements that you're doing to shift the truck. And then you have the issue of weight gain, diabetes, and obesity, which plagues truck drivers, in addition to air quality. So you're never more than a couple hundred feet away from an idling diesel engine. I mean, 24 hours a day, you're breathing diesel exhaust, which has known carcinogens and is not good for your lungs or your heart.
Well, and tell me about your experience. Tell me what your truck was like.
So my truck had a bunk in the back, so it had two beds, one on top of the other, and I was driving alone, so that top one was unoccupied. I had my fridge and my satellite radio, my CB radio. It becomes kind of your little space, and wherever you go, whether it's an asphalt lot or a country road or something, it's your home.
Many of the people you interviewed talked about decisions that they later came to regret. What were those decisions?
So the big one was contracting. So this is a choice that most truck drivers who stay more than a year or two in long-haul trucking will be presented with and will consider seriously, which is the chance to become what is traditionally called an owner-operator, where they're going to buy the truck that they're driving and then be responsible for all of the expenses associated with driving that truck. And almost universally, what I found was that drivers regretted that decision. Now, some regretted it a little bit, and others regretted it a lot because of the consequences that came from it.
And the title obviously has independent in it, independent contracting. Was that the appeal, the idea of being one's own boss?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, because of those bad days that I was talking about before, and I read that little clip of, you know, you're there and you're not getting paid, you end up as an employee driver, with a sense of course, a lack of control, where your priorities are not the priorities of the other folks in the process, and particularly those who are making the decisions. And so what you end up thinking as an employee, what I ended up thinking was, you know, if I could just get control over the work that got assigned to me, this job would be so much better. I could avoid all of these really bad loads that are ruining my day. And that's what independent contracting promises these drivers. And it's not just a promise that companies make to drivers. They do make that promise. But it's also a legal requirement. So our laws that govern independent contracting say that workers have to have the right to choose the work that they do.
And why, in the end, does it seem as though this was not a good model, the owner-operator model was not a good model for many truckers you talk to?
So that promise of control that companies give doesn't end up being real. They can't actually give truckers control. And it's part of that bigger story of deregulation and the way that it changed freight movements. Companies today are very large, have very sophisticated, tightly scheduled freight movements and processes that require that truckers do the work that's assigned to them. And so giving, you know, the average truck driver the ability to choose which loads they want would mess up the efficiency, would reduce the efficiency of that system. And so in the end, what truckers end up realizing is that they have to take the work that's offered to them by the company.
I'm Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler, and my guest is Steve Viselli. He's the author of a new book called The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. And I'd like you to read one more passage from your book on page 194. It's called No More Jimmy Hoffas.
Truckers have serious grievances. At the top of the list are low wages, huge amounts of unpaid work, and lots of time spent away from home. Employees and contractors virtually all believe that these problems are so severe that truckers should engage in collective action to address them. When I asked drivers what they should do about their problems, the vast majority suggested they should strike, and believed that a successful strike would have dramatic consequences. Most drivers said something like this: "If truckers went on strike, it would shut this country down. Trucks move this country, and at some point somebody would have to pay attention to the needs of the trucker. Truckers have to get better working conditions and more money." Every trucker I talked to had a similar perspective on drivers' critical position in the economy and on the potential power that gave truckers to engage in collective action that would disrupt the economy. Unfortunately, high turnover among employees and the prevalence of contracting are circumstances that fracture the industry's labor force and prevent drivers from organizing themselves.
It is certainly difficult to imagine what would happen if truckers went on strike. It does seem as though the world would stop.
It would.
To be honest.
they're right. So within a few days, the average consumer would begin to feel the pain. And you could just imagine something along the lines of the shortages that happened after Sandy, right? But nationwide. And they wouldn't be because of a local delivery problem, but they would be sort of at the major hubs, distribution centers, et cetera, that would not have the goods to then go out to the stores.
You say that so many truckers you spoke to talk about that sort of thing. Why has it not happened?
So truckers tried a few years ago during the Great Recession. There was a spike in diesel fuel prices that happened along around the same time. There were several calls nationally for strikes by individual truckers, not by any organizations. Some truckers began to try to form organizations and engage in strikes. And so there were some convoys and some work stoppages by truck drivers, but they never really caught on. And part of the reason they never caught on was because independent contractors weren't able to convince employee drivers that they should also stop driving. And the employee drivers, of course, were not responsible for paying for their fuel and so weren't getting hurt.
Right, so the schism that exists within the industry. And then I also wondered if maybe some of it was the fact that truckers are not all in the same place, right? In a factory, all the workers are in the same building. They see each other. They talk to each other at lunch. Should we do this? Should we not? Whereas truckers, by necessity, see each other for a few minutes or an hour over lunch at a truck stop, and that's it. They may never see that person again. Probably won't.
Exactly. So, and this is one of the things that more experienced drivers would very quickly point out when the topic of a strike came up. They would say, how are you going to organize people? Back before deregulation, we used to all be home every night working from the same terminals. You'd see drivers, you know, regularly, and you could develop relationships, and those relationships are critical to getting somebody to trust you to say, hey, I'm not going to work tomorrow. You shouldn't either. You know, that's a big deal. And it's hard to do that when I never saw the same person from my company twice in the 6 months that I worked for this company.
I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about Claudio. He's one of the characters you mentioned in the book. Why has his story stuck with you? Tell me about him.
Yeah, so Claudio was such a powerful experience for me. We talked for a long time, and the way that I got interviews was I would approach people in the truck stop on their breaks and ask if they had time. And virtually everyone who was on a break said yes, which was an indication of how lonely the job is. And when I sat down with Claudio, he seemed a little more tense than most. And I quickly realized why. And it was because he was kind of right at the worst place in the contracting experience. So Claudio had by this point had several paychecks in which he ended up paying the company. Now Claudio had been a pretty successful long haul driver, earning about $40,000 a year, going out for 2 weeks at a time. But he had some trouble during Hurricane Katrina, where he was dispatched right into the storm and got into a conflict with his dispatcher and ended up deciding that he needed more control. And so he signed up with a big company as an independent contractor. And his first paycheck out, he only had a 5-day week, and he ended up owing the company some money. And then he sort of went out on this work marathon for you know, 6 weeks to 2 months, which is not at all uncommon for these independent contractors to go out for months at a time without returning home. And the week that I met him, he had just received his paycheck for a previous 7-day week that he had worked, where he ended up making something like $48. and he had probably worked somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 hours that week. And he was in the truck stop because he was trying to get his dispatcher, his driver manager, on the phone to complain about this paycheck that he had. Now, here is a worker who, you know, in the previous year was able to earn about $40,000, and he would have liked to have made more. He was hoping to go into business potentially for himself in the future and things like that, but was now basically working for free.
It's interesting that we pass truckers on the road all the time, right? But yet often don't really think about the fact that there's a person up there in that huge vehicle. Do you think about that now when you're out on the highway in your smaller car and you look up?
Absolutely. And, you know, I have to say one of the comments that I've gotten from people who've read the book is, oh, my God, you've made me so scared on the highway. I'm worried that this truck driver hasn't slept, didn't sleep the night before. And my response to people generally is the people who are most concerned about trucker safety are the truckers themselves. And 99% of them are doing everything they can to ensure that they're doing the best job they can. So don't pull in front of them and slam on the brakes. If we gave those workers more control over their working conditions and pay, they could be even safer. And that's the first thing that they would do.
I'm Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler, and my guest has been Steve Viselli. He's the author of a new book called The Big Rig: Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Coming up, I'll be talking with Ellen Voya about how to get more women truck drivers. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We've been talking about what it's like to be a long-haul truck driver, a largely male occupation. Well, our guest wants to change that. Ellen Voya joined us by Skype, and she's the president and CEO of the Women in Trucking Association, a nonprofit she founded back in 2007 to encourage the employment of women in the trucking industry. Ellen Voya, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We're hoping this is a good Skype connection. Just say hello again, if you don't mind, Ellen.
Sure. Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
All righty. Well, hopefully we can either fix this or we might get you on a different phone line. But let me give out the phone number to our listeners, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're going to get her back on what we hope is going to be a better phone line. And we just heard about 40 minutes of Steve Viselli talking about what it's like to be a long-haul truck driver. And as Liz Fiedler said, driving down the road, you pass or they pass you these big trucks on the highway. And one often wonders, well, what is it like to be a truck driver? And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Ellen, do we have you?
Yes, I'm on. Thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. Nice to have you with us on Radio Time. So why does the truck driving industry need women truck drivers?
Well, the industry has really changed a lot, and companies are placing a lot more importance on the person behind the wheel because of capacity issues. So they're working hard to get drivers home a lot more. We're working hard to change the truck cab design and ergonomics and make sure that it's comfortable for women as well. And the technology in the trucks has really made it a less physically demanding job than it was in the past.
And are women truck drivers, do they drive differently from men?
Oh, yes. Women take fewer risks. And so the statistics that we have show that women are involved in much fewer accidents. And when women are in an accident, it's at lower speeds. So there's less loss of life and less damage to the equipment. So women are very valued as professional drivers.
What are the barriers, though? And is it an image issue? Is the industry, you think, welcoming enough to women who want to drive a truck?
Well, from inside the industry, it's very welcoming. But I think that the view from outside the industry is that it's not. And we're trying to change that. We need to show women that, first of all, that they're very capable of doing this job and that the industry wants more women, both at the driver level and at the leadership level. Diversity is very important. And they're setting goals. The companies are setting, you know, targets to bring more women in. So, yes, we definitely have an image problem. And that's one of the things that Women in Trucking Association is trying to change.
Well, I think one of those images, and you referenced this earlier, is just that you need to be really big and strong in order to be able to drive a gigantic truck, a hauling, I'm sure, tons of goods. But you reference the fact that the technology has really made this much more, what, girl-friendly, if I can say that?
Oh, sure. It's because of an aging driver population, it also accommodates men and women who might not be as physically capable as they were, you know, in their 20s and 30s. But the technology has made it so much easier that when you're in a truck, and especially those with automated transmissions, you're high up, but it's not as difficult to drive as people might think. And with the changes in loading and unloading, carriers advertise what they call no-touch freight. So the driver is responsible only for driving the truck down the road instead of the physically demanding parts that might have been perceived that they'd done in the past.
What percentage of truck drivers are female?
It's just under 6%. We believe it's a little higher. Those are government numbers, so we're working on a Women in Trucking Index. But it's only about 1 out of 20 drivers that you see on the road is a female.
And I read that the average age is 51, which I have to say surprised me.
Well, most women who get into the trucking industry have already raised their family. And they're, you know, someone, a husband or a father, boyfriend or somebody has convinced them to go to truck driving school, get their commercial license, and team with them. 50 to 60% of the women who work in the trucking industry as drivers are in a team configuration. So a lot of them come into the industry because somebody encouraged them.
Well, and it's interesting hearing from our first guest talking about what it's like for truck drivers, largely male truck drivers, and the challenges of trying to raise a family and be a truck driver, especially a long-haul truck driver, when you're on the road so much. Are there efforts not just for women but also for men to make it more family-friendly?
Very much so. And I had that same experience. I was married to an over-the-road driver for 20 years. And he would be gone up to 6 weeks at a time.
Wow.
In the past. But carriers are really working now to make sure that the jobs are more regional or even local so that drivers are either home nightly or 2-3 times a week or at the very least, on weekends if possible, so that they do have a better work-life balance. So the industry really is changing, maybe not fast enough, but it is changing.
You have a Class A commercial driver's license. I frankly don't even know what that means. What does that mean? What does that mean, Ellen?
It means that I went to truck driving school and I can drive a truck.
Have you driven a truck?
Yes, I have. I have. I finished my truck driving school, got my commercial driver's license, and I have driven it, but I only have 126 safe driving miles, so not very much.
And is it because you've got this nonprofit, you're trying to get other women to drive trucks?
Yes, and I wanted to go through the school to get the experience. And so I wrote a book called Crushing Cones, and it's about, you know, what skills do you need, what my experience was like, what the test is like. And we even included shifting patterns and what's a pintle hook and things like that so that somebody can be better prepared before they attend truck driving school.
Let me get Tay from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I actually started driving trucks. I've been driving for 17 years. I'm actually 42. I started driving when I was 25. I actually came into the industry as a challenge to myself to drive the biggest truck on the road. And it wasn't male-dominated, and it is male-dominated. And I do find it hard sometimes to be taken serious as a woman driver to get out, and they like, you're driving that truck? I'm like, yeah, I'm driving that truck. And I do agree with your guest to say, that women do have that more of the safety precautions that men do. I'm more courteous. I'm more patient. I do think about my children that I have at home that I have to get home to, and that's always my main focus. So I do agree with that to say that men are more aggressive in driving, and I notice they will drive faster on the road. And unfortunately, being a truck driver, I have to call in some of my colleagues, maybe to their company, because they're doing things that's erratic and maybe not in a safe way. So I do notice that. But myself also has tried to convince some of my female friends to come on board because raising two daughters of my own, I realized that having the one job actually allowed me to be home more, being a local driver versus having to have one or two, maybe three jobs just to maintain my bills. So I do agree totally with bringing more females on board because this is an industry where you can make $50,000, maybe even $80,000 being local.
Well, you know, that's so interesting, Tay, because I was going to ask you whether you can make a good living or not. And that was one of the things that came up in Liz's interview with Steve Iselli, which is for a lot of long-haul truck drivers. To you, Ellen, and Tay, thanks for calling into Radio Times. There was some concern about whether you can really make a good living being a truck driver.
You can, and wages are increasing. Wages have been going up the last couple of years because of the capacity challenges. So in the past, it was harder, I think, although 20 years ago, it was much easier to make a living. But it's been a challenge, but the wages are going up again. And, you can start just right around the $40,000 mark, and that's after, you know, 3-4 weeks of training.
You went through training, and what is training like? And there were some questions raised in the previous interview about how safe women feel when they're being trained, especially a male trainer. Have you found that to be true?
That's true. And because of the, you know, the legal challenges, some carriers have tried to use female trainers with female trainees. But then the EEOC challenged them because it took longer to get a female trainee trained. So it's gender neutral. But we have an anti-harassment employment guide that we offer to carriers with the driver expectations exchange in there and, you know, have them talk about things before they go out in the truck. But the training experience it's after you go to truck driving school, you basically have your commercial driver's license. And then you go to a carrier and you need to go out with their trainer for, a week or a 2 or 3 weeks just to get the experience from that carrier to understand their paperwork, their procedures, their customers and things like that. So it's a challenge, but it can be overcome.
Tay, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Ellen, let me read a comment from Donna. She says, I'm an OTR driver, 26 years in the industry, was fun learning now, learning now just a job. I do it because it's my job. Worst problem has been insurance rates for me as a healthy person. I just pay for the possibility of a high rate. No sexual harassment at all. It's how you respond to the sexism. But for her, she says, this is my job. This is what I do. No big deal.
Right. And, you know, as far as the insurance, that's not really an industry concern. But OTR means over the road, which means she's long haul.
Right.
So that means she's away from home for, a while. But I love what she said about harassment, because harassment is, you know, it's something that's different for different people. So we tell women, if someone tells a joke and you're offended by that joke, or if they make a comment, you have a responsibility to tell them to stop. And then if they continue, then it is harassment. So it's really something that you have to address right away.
Are truck stops women friendly enough for you?
We're working on that. We're working with the largest TA Petro Petro stopping centers, and they're putting in, they have unisex showers where before it was more of a locker room type situation, but they've changed to unisex showers. They're putting in big shower heads and hair dryers and big fluffy towels. So, and they're adding more security. They're adding more lighting and paying attention to how safe the environment is at the truck stop. So things are changing for the better.
Well, I was thinking about being in a strange place, being alone, perhaps at night, sleeping in your cab. I mean, these are all things that I think everyone has to think about, but I think women in particular have to think about.
Well, that's correct. And we're working with the truck cab manufacturers on ergonomics and truck cab design. And one of the features that we have asked them to include and I hope to see in the coming year is a security alarm system so that if somebody does try to break in the truck, that the horns will go off and the lights will flash and, you know, the driver will be alerted so that we can ward off anyone who tries to break in the cab.
You mentioned the fact that there's some ergonomic challenges. How are trucks either designed or redesigned to fit a woman's body?
Well, women typically have shorter arms, shorter legs, wider hips. And so we're working with the truck cab manufacturers on the steps, getting in and out and getting into the sleeper cab part, the slope of the dash so that you can see over the dash and be able to see the mirrors. Also, the adjustability of the steering column and the pedals, because if someone is shorter, and it could be men too, if they're shorter, then they can't see over the dash or they can't reach the pedals, one or the other. And so many women have told me that they've had to sit on pillows or, you know, things like that. And we just don't believe that that should be the case. We think women should be just as comfortable in a truck as their male counterparts.
Well, let me get Renee, who's joining us from Route 276. Renee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I love trucking. I'm sad that I didn't get into it years before this. You know, and the income is just amazing. And the funny thing is, I haven't saved a penny yet this year because I'm enjoying spending it all.
And Renee, I see here I'm a female truck driver. I make up to $20,000 or up to $70,000. So a wide discrepancy there.
I was a hairdresser and I started at $20,000 and I am now I should make up to about $76,000 at the end of this year.
Oh, I hear you. So this is a big financial jump for you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the kids are out of the house.
And I'm curious how old you are, because we have a couple of comments or questions here about the age of a truck driver. Renee, how old are you?
I'm 51, and I'm 120 pounds, 5'4".
And 5'4". Mm-hmm. And driving a big...
driving a big rig. I step out, and people just stare. They're like, you're so tiny. And I'm like, not really, but okay, thanks.
Ellen, anything you want to say back to Renee?
Renee, any challenges on the truck cab design?
Yeah, good question.
Rolling up the landing gear is always a challenge, and of course, backing.
And of course what?
Backing into dock or into another space.
But you're talking about even climbing into the cab can be a challenge for someone who's 5'4"?
No, backing the rig into a parking spot.
Oh, I got you. Makes sense to you, Ellen?
Yeah, it does. And being able to see adequately, because there are a lot of blind spots on a truck or trailer.
Great. Well, I appreciate, Renee, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And there are a couple of questions about age, Ellen. Is there a point in which a person, we're talking about women truck drivers, but a person is too old to drive a truck?
Not at all. In fact, as long as they can pass a physical, they're required to get a physical every 2 years at the outset or more often, I should say, if they have other issues like diabetes or anything like that. But if they can pass a physical, then they're good to go, regardless of their age.
Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Ellen Voya, president and CEO of the Women in Trucking Association. That's a nonprofit she founded back in 2007. And we appreciate those phone calls from truck drivers on the road. We always appreciate that. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We've been having a Twitter and Facebook conversation about the trucking industry, so you can certainly join that as well. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Liz Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.